Good afternoon. I'm Rachel Lindley, WBHM's news director. In this next half hour, we're listening to highlights from the last year at WBHM News. I'm joined now by our All Things Considered host and reporter, Sarah D'Elia. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Rachel.
Today, we're going to listen to your story on the Lyric Theater. But first, you recently celebrated your one-year anniversary in Birmingham and at WBHM as well. So happy anniversary.
Thank
first.
You.
After living in and reporting in Birmingham for 1 year, what surprised you the most about being in the city?
I think what surprised me the most is how many stories there are here. I knew coming from Fort Wayne, Indiana, some of the history of civil rights and the different movements here in the South. But seeing that there's other stories besides what's going on with those civil rights issues, the musicians that are here, the arts movement that's here, all of our political struggles and triumphs in Birmingham, it's just kind of like an endless plethora of stories here. There's always a story to tell. There's someone interesting wherever you go. So as a reporter, it's a great thing.
So for your story on the Lyric, at the time that you reported this, this was last year in November, officials were working to restore the theater. They're still doing that now. And some of the obstacles that they were working around at that time, funding the project, removing lead paint, plumbing issues. Also, another very interesting challenge involving their balcony, the colored balcony, which we hear more about in the story. First, how did you hear about this aspect of the Lyric's restoration that no one really had been reporting on at the time?
Well, I knew I wanted to do a story about the Lyric because it's just so beautiful. You walk downtown and it's just something that stops you in your tracks. So I called Glennie Brock, who works for Birmingham Landmark. She's their outreach coordinator, and she gave me a tour. And I think the tour, it lasted at least 2 hours. I mean, the Lyric is huge. There are numerous floors. It's not just the theater. It's also the office area that is a whole other story to tell in and of itself. And one thing that Glennie told me about when we went up to what was known as the colored balcony, because African Americans at that time of segregation would enter a different entrance, and that's where they would sit. And, you know, one of the things she pointed out to me was, you know, they were having a lot of interesting conversations about how to preserve this part of our history. Surely we don't want to celebrate the racial tensions and very difficult things that went on during that time, but we don't want to forget about it either. So how do we preserve this piece of history in the Lyric? And that's where the story came from.
Those issues are very obvious because they're built right into the building,
right,
which opened in 1914.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And before we get into the story, talking a little bit more about the building itself, it's been abandoned for a very long time. And you, as a reporter, got something of the all-inclusive tour of the Lyric. What are some of the spaces? Just describe some of the spaces that you went into that aren't included on the regular tour.
So one thing that I did with Glennie was we were standing on top of the stage, and she was kind of showing me the areas, how people would get on stage, get off stage, how the stage was laid out. And I kind of was like, what's underneath the stage, though? Because if you take a tour of the Alabama, you can see where the dressing rooms were and all those things. The dressing rooms for the Lyric are actually under the stage. And so I said, I'd really like to look underneath there. It's not as accessible. And you might not think to go underneath it unless you want to explore every inch of a place. So we went under. You kind of have to like straddle a little barrier for the orchestra pit and then slide down. And it was just really cool. You could see some graffiti that was still there from the early 1900s. And you could kind of just imagine people running around, changing costumes. I think there was still a sink down there, too. So you kind of could picture what it was like to be a vaudeville actor, performer, and be in the underbelly of the Lyric. It was really neat, especially knowing that most people don't get to go down there.
We're talking with our reporter, Sarah D'Elia, about her story on the Lyric. Let's listen to it now, exploring how you can faithfully restore a historic building still physically marked by Birmingham's racist past.
Are y'all ready to count it down? All right. We're going to start off at 10.
That's Birmingham Mayor William Bell speaking to a crowd gathered for the lighting of the new Lyric marquee back in October. All eyes were glued to the white cursive letters, the audience holding their collective breath. It took a while, but finally, the marquee is lit, a sign of progress in renovating the historic Vaudeville Theater. When the Lyric opened, it was one of the first theaters in the South where blacks and whites could see the same show at the same time for the same price. But it was still segregated. Whites entered the theater on 3rd Avenue North, which had an ornate marquee. Blacks entered through a separate door on 18th Street. Whites entered through the main lobby and sat close to the stage. Black patrons followed a hallway that led to the colored balcony.
So we've arrived in the topmost balcony. This was the colored balcony. You know, because of the laws in the city at that time, it could not be a fully integrated place, because no place was fully integrated. But the accommodation that was made was separate entrance, separate seating.
Glennie Brock works for Birmingham Landmarks, the nonprofit responsible for the restoration of the Lyric Theater and the Alabama State Theater. To call Brock a mere cheerleader for the Lyric is an understatement. She's especially passionate when it comes to the fate of the colored balcony and colored entrance.
I have never wanted anybody to have the sense that we are preserving the colored entrance and the colored balcony because we're like whistling Dixie and saying that, like, we wish we could do it this way again. I have never wanted it to come off as anything other than a recognition of this is who we were.
Birmingham Landmarks has already diverged from history with the entrances. Both now have identical marquees which lead to the main lobby, eliminating any separation. But they are still wrestling with what to do with the colored balcony. And they have a lot of options. The chairs that were installed in the 1940s could be restored. Some of the chairs could be donated to the Civil Rights Institute. Bleachers could be reinstalled. That was the original seating in the colored balcony in 1914.
It's something that we need to be real sensitive to.
Danny Evans, the board chair of Birmingham Landmarks.
We don't want there to be any current separation or segregation or any indication like that. If it has a significance, it has a significance to remind us that those were wounds that we want to be healed, but we don't want to forget.
I don't think we're going to please everybody, but we just want to get it right. We just want to get it right.
But when it comes to historic preservation, how do you define getting it right? It's a tough call, says former Auburn University history professor Wayne Flint.
If you don't put the segregated stuff back in the Lyric Theater, that's basically saying this is the way it was when it was a functioning piece of Birmingham history. If you do leave the segregated seating in there, it's a constant reminder to people who go in there, but no one who goes in there is unaware of what happened anyway.
Flint says Birmingham Landmarks white staff members are bound to experience unease when confronted by the theater's past. Still, he says, it's part of Birmingham's history and can't be ignored.
As an historian, I must confess that what I would tell white people in Birmingham is get over it. You are what you are. Back there, there's nothing you can do to make all that story different than what it is. So what you do is you incorporate it, and then you use it to point out how far Birmingham has moved, and hopefully it has.
Retired historian Dr. Horace Huntley agrees the history of the Lyric should be incorporated in the restoration. As a black teenager in the 50s and 60s, Huntley experienced the segregation in the theater firsthand. Despite those memories, Huntley is looking forward to the reopening of the theater. He says the Lyric could have an important role in the revitalization of downtown, a role it can only play with its doors open. So it's hard for him to understand the fear of not getting the restoration right.
I don't think that there is a need to be that concerned about what it will be. We know what it will not be, and that is what is important to me as a person who grew up in Birmingham. It will not be the same Lyric.
Organizers plan to reopen the Lyric Theater sometime in 2014, the same year as its 100th birthday. They hope the old vaudeville theater can become a place for everyone to gather without forgetting the separation of the past. For WBHM, I'm Sarah D'Elia.
You're listening to WBHM. This afternoon, we're talking about some of the behind-the-scenes stories that happen when our reporters are out in the field bringing you the stories that you hear each day on the radio. We just heard from Sarah D'Elia and her story on restoring the Lyric. So, Sarah, you reported originally on that in November. What's going on now with the Lyric? Bring us up to speed.
So the part that I focused the most on in my story was centered around the colored balcony. I've talked to the folks at the Birmingham Landmarks, and they are kind of still in a zone where they're trying to figure out what to do. So they haven't made the decisions yet. They have some options on the table. They're still kind of thinking about what is the right thing to do. They have removed the actual chairs from the colored balcony. They're in the process of restoring them, deciding if some will be donated to places like the Civil Rights Institute, but they haven't made those important decisions that will have to be made eventually. The other big thing, of course, too, is that they have pushed back the opening date of the Lyric. They were originally going to open its doors in December of 2014, but, you know, these things take time. There are costs, there are construction issues that you just sometimes can't anticipate. So they're hopeful that the summer of 2015, they will be able to open their doors for good to the public and have people in and have shows going, hopefully.
Well, Sarah, thank you for sitting down with me and telling me more about the process you went through reporting on the Lyric. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Today we're showcasing some of the best stories from WBHM's news team from the past year. I'm joined now by Dan Carson. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Rachel.
He's our education reporter for the Southern Education Desk. The story that we're going to talk about is Homebound Student Doing Much More Than Surviving. This is the story of a unique young man. His name is Joseph Walter, and he has Pompe disease. And that's a rare and often fatal illness. It attacks the heart, the skeletal muscles. And many people who have this in the early onset form, they don't survive past childhood. But Joseph Walter's different, and at the time that you met him, he had recently graduated from high school. This was just around this time last year that you went to talk to him.
Right.
So at the time that you reported this story, it was a very different kind of assignment for you.
It was. It was a real sort of departure from the typical, you know, big picture educational policy stuff that I had been doing. I mean, it was summertime. I was given a little leeway, which I really appreciate. And I had been hearing about Joseph Walter for a while, and it was something that I wanted to at least look into. Yeah, it definitely was a different type of story for me.
So the story starts with you arriving at the house. You're meeting Joseph Walter and his mother. You describe this scene in the story, but what were you thinking, especially because this was so different than the kind of reporting you'd done before?
Right. You know, reporters, we're always going to sort of interesting, like weird, out-of-the-way places, and you never really know what to expect. So I don't get my hopes up. I didn't have my hopes up. I really had no idea where it was going to go or even if it was going to be worth a story. You know, it wasn't that far out of town. It's just, you know, a half-hour drive north, basically. Yeah, I really didn't know what to expect.
Were you nervous at all?
I was a little nervous. I mean, you never want to even, you know, give off a hint that you might be exploiting someone's disability or anything like that. But the way I heard about Joseph, basically the person who does the press relations for Jefferson County Schools, who is a dynamo and is very good at getting out lots of information. She raved about this kid in a way that made me think like, okay, this isn't just her job. This is something she personally cares about and thinks would make a good story. So I mean, I guess I was a little bit optimistic, but then again, I didn't let my expectations get too crazy. I was a little nervous, you know, I wasn't really sure how to carry myself in that situation, but you know, I did what reporters do. We just go into these places and see what's happening.
And you won a Regional Murrow Award for this story. You won to Best Feature and also Best Use of Sound. So how for you did sound play a part in this story?
Well, luckily, I went to do this story right about the time that I was really learning to think like a radio reporter as opposed to a print reporter. You know, in print, obviously, background sound doesn't come up. As soon as I walked into the room where Joseph spends most of his time, you know, I realized it was a very sound-rich environment. There were, you know, his ventilator that keeps him going. There was the computer that he uses to communicate with people. They all made certain kinds of sounds, and luckily, I was learning how to sort of listen like a radio reporter, and I realized that this is really going to help me sort of get our listeners to this room.
Well, let's listen to the story. This is Homebound Student Doing Much More Than Surviving, the story of Joseph Walter, who has Pompe disease.
I first heard about Joseph Walter from someone whose job is trumpeting school's accomplishments, so I'm a little skeptical that he'll, quote, change me. But I go to meet him and his best translator, his mother, Deborah, at their house in Clay, Alabama. Thank you.
Hey.
Hey, how are you? It's
good
to meet you in person. Dan Carson, hey.
Debbie, he's back here. This is Joseph.
I'm not.
This is so nice.
Joseph can move only one thumb and two fingers, one on each hand. He's in a special chair in the main room, which is decorated with movie posters and other art. He's hooked up to a ventilator and to something else important, the computer that connects him to the outside world. It's got a little joystick that moves a cursor over letters. Joseph types them by using his other hand to click a button. But he didn't have that back in his early school days.
Most of his tests were multiple choice. He'd read the question, and then he would sing the and I'd say, is your answer D? And then I could tell by his eyes.
That's Pam Smith, the Jefferson County educator who is Joseph's homebound teacher since he was in first grade. He's never been in a standard classroom.
People don't really understand. How good a classroom is. Because at least if you're in a classroom, they explain it to you.
Math gave him the most trouble.
You and me take out a scratch piece of paper and work our problems out. He can't do that. He does it in his head.
Joseph wasn't expected to live past 2, but he just graduated high school, ranked 20th out of almost 300. His language arts ACT scores are well into the nation's top 10%. And crucially for Joseph and his family, who have insurance but struggle with out-of-pocket costs, he's earned a full scholarship to Kaplan Online University worth $67,000.
The lady on the phone said, you've got a scholarship to Kaplan, and he couldn't talk. He just closed his eyes and had tears running down his face.
Part of what got him the scholarship is his writing, which Pam Smith calls off the charts. It's one way his wicked sense of humor gets to come out and play. A family favorite is an essay that makes the case for cooking children. It's actually a satire of wealth inequality and stereotypes. But just in case I didn't get that, Joseph promises he's not a famous movie villain.
You don't actually think what? Cooking children is good? No, not Hannibal, no. Even though we watch it, because he has to watch all those things because that's what his field is going to be.
Joseph wants to be a forensic psychologist specializing in facial micro-movement detection. In other words, he wants to look at video of people's faces and help law enforcement tell whether they're lying. He's completed a nearby police department Citizens Academy course, and he's writing a detective novel. Joseph has been defying expectations for years. He's had support, his parents, teachers, tutors, nurses, but he seems to help those who know him at least as much as they help him, normally jaded reporters included.
Is there anything else, something that I might have forgotten to ask you?
He just wants to make sure people know that you always keep fighting, no matter what.
It's easier to take advice from people who back it up themselves. Perspective adjusted. For the Southern Education Desk in Birmingham, I'm Dan Carson.
That story by Dan Carson won a Regional Murrow Award for Best Feature and also Best Use of Sound. Dan, reporting this story, it did have a profound effect on you.
Yeah, it really did. This was a departure for me in terms of the type of story. It was less sort of policy or, you know, let's say heated controversy over Common Core, where if anyone's going to take you seriously as a reporter, you have to try to be objective. You know, a story like this, it's not quite as important. I'm telling a human story in this story the best way I know how, and I'm just very happy that I got a chance to do it.
And since you have kept up with him, what is Joseph doing now?
Well, he's in college, and he's getting through his first year, and according to a very proud mother, he's made the dean's list a couple of times. He's doing really well. He's doing particularly well in his criminal investigations class. He wants to be someone who looks at videotapes to tell whether people are lying. You know, who knows? Maybe this kid might end up being like the Stephen Hawking of forensics. I could totally see that happening because, you know, he's defied expectations for so long. When he was born, at the time, the treatments now are not great, but they're better than they were then. His parents were told he wasn't going to live past 2. You know, now he's getting done with his first year of college. And it's apparently going really well. It's been successful. He's also co-secretary of a club at Kaplan Online University. It's called DREAM, and it's basically a group that organizes, educates, and advocates for students with disabilities. Oh, he's had a tongue surgery recently, which in the long term may help his breathing and his communication. I guess that remains to be seen. It was a little bit painful, but he's healed up, and it's going really well. Oh, and he just got a new motorized wheelchair. And his mom describes that as a learning experience. So I can sort of picture him, you know, zooming around, maybe bumping into things. Maybe I'll do a follow up on how that's going at some point, or just stop by and check in on him. But yeah, so that'll help with his mobility. I mean, that's got to be a good hopeful thing too.
Well, thanks, Stan, for telling us more about the story behind that story.
Oh, anytime, my pleasure.
I'm Rachel Lindley. We've been talking with WBHM's education reporter Dan Carson about his story, Homebound Student Doing Much More Than Surviving. If you missed it, you can hear it again at WBHM.org. We're listening to highlights from the last year at WBHM News. In 1965, civil rights protesters began a march from Selma to Montgomery, but they didn't make it far. Protesters were met in a bridge by police who beat them with billy clubs and sprayed the crowd with tear gas. The event is known as Bloody Sunday. Each year, thousands of people commemorate Bloody Sunday by marching across that same bridge in Selma. Last year, Andrew Yeager reported on Bloody Sunday for WBHM and NPR. Hi, Andrew, and thanks for joining me.
Hi, Rachel.
So this march, it's an annual event, and you visited Selma last year at a time when parts of the Voting Rights Act were in question. You described this challenge a bit more in the story, which we'll hear in a moment. But first, how did this challenge to the Voting Rights Act change the way that you approached covering the march?
Well, basically, it gave us a reason to cover the march. This is something that happens every year. It's a reenactment. It's a commemoration of those events from 1965. And as something that happens every year, it's something that we as journalists don't pay attention to quite the same. We mark it, but that's it. So the fact that there was a challenge to the Voting Rights Act before the Supreme Court had been argued, it hadn't been decided yet, it gave us a reason to go back to Selma. And that's specifically why NPR was interested in a story on this, was because it gave that those events in Selma, it gave them more importance this past year, because, you know, people were thinking about these issues in a little different way. It wasn't just marking what happened 48 years before. It was, you know, this still has importance today.
And so you arrived in Selma that day, and there were thousands of people there. So how do you even start in a situation like that? How do you decide what to record and who to talk to?
Well, you do a little prep work ahead of time. So I knew going into it that there were certain people, organizations I wanted to talk to. You make phone calls ahead of time and schedule those things as you can. The interesting thing about going to the reenactment that particular year was the headline speaker was Vice President Joe Biden. Attorney General Eric Holder was also speaking. You had some very prominent individuals, and that means security. They actually had metal detectors set up in the streets in Selma, areas cordoned off. We had to go through bags checked, very tight security.
Do you have any trouble with a radio recording kit going through security like that?
Well, you have to submit all your information ahead of time to the Secret Service. So they knew who I was. They had the opportunity to check me out. And they actually on site, once you get through the ID and all that, it's just a matter of going through every pocket in your bag and making sure that what appears to be a radio recorder, an audio recorder, is just that.
So you won a Regional Moreau Award, a very high honor in radio, for writing for this story. So you went out to Selma that day. You captured all of your sound, interviewed all the people that you talked with in the crowd. Then what did you do? What's your process for writing the story?
Well, I had a pretty quick turnaround because all that sound was gathered on a Saturday afternoon, and this had to air the following morning. So there wasn't a whole lot of time to really sit and dwell and make second choices and things like that. So, basically, I sort of thought, what are the most important things that capture what happened that day? And in terms of writing, how can I take this, very visual scene of a crush of people going over the Edmund Pettus Bridge? How can I translate that to radio and what I write and the sound that I use? And fortunately, this was a case of the piece kind of writing itself. I had people that gave me good interviews, gave me good material to work with, and had very compelling visuals that I could use to write and shape the piece.
Well, let's listen to the story now.
About a block away from the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where police and marchers clashed 48 years ago, Selma native Will Harris stands along the street, He's excited. It's the 25th time he's been here. A camera hangs from his neck, ready to capture the day's festivities.
It's just remarkable, man. It's just a feeling you can't get over, especially when you're like in a building upstairs and you look out and can see thousands and thousands of people, and you're like, this is in my city.
The annual reenactment may harken back to the past, but its spirit is very much of the present. Last week, justices heard a challenge brought by an Alabama county over part of the Voting Rights Act. It's a provision which requires some states, mostly in the South, to get permission from the Justice Department before making changes to voting regulations. Alabama officials argue that section is cumbersome and no longer necessary. Questions asked by the court's conservative justices led some observers to suggest this part of the Voting Rights Act could be struck down. In Selma, the Supreme Court is front of mind, as speaker after speaker alludes to the case. The Reverend Jesse Jackson uses it to rally the crowd.
I must vote. The Supreme Court can't take it. If they try, we'll fight back.
Proponents of the law say voting rights still need to be protected. Gwendolyn Ferretti with the Hispanic Interest Coalition of Alabama says some county registrars in the state are asking extra unnecessary questions of naturalized citizens when registering. Latino voters are viewed with suspicion.
This is something that we shouldn't be doing. We shouldn't be limiting people's access to vote. We should be trying to encourage as many people who are eligible to vote to do so.
Marchers sing familiar anthems of the civil rights movement, their voices bumping up against the roar of police motorcycles. This time, police clear the way for the marchers as they stream onto the bridge. Some are small children carried by parents. Others return to the spot where they were bloodied 48 years ago. The songs keep coming.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
The weight of this event isn't lost on Justin Dunn. He's a student at Valparaiso University in Indiana, here on a school trip.
Walking across there was really powerful. We've had a lot of sessions where we talked about what happened here on Bloody Sunday, so that made it a lot more intense. You know, it's been a great experience.
Carolyn Doyle King's experience as a student at this bridge is different. She wears a homemade sign over her shoulders, held together by pink ribbon. It declares, "Foot Soldier, I was here in 1965. She's not happy the Voting Rights Act is under scrutiny by the courts.
We can't do that. We can't go back. It shouldn't even be a question of taking back any of that. We should be pushing forward and pushing ahead.
Not surprisingly, her viewpoint is echoed often among those gathered in Selma. However, the future of the Voting Rights Act will be determined far away from here by the nine men and women of the U.S. Supreme Court. For WBHM, I'm Andrew Yeager.
You're listening to WBHM. This afternoon, we're telling the stories behind the news stories you hear each day from WBHM's news team. I'm Rachel Lindley, and we're talking with Andrew Yeager about the story you just heard called Remembering Bloody Sunday. Andrew, you visited Selma last year, and that was just a few days after parts of the Voting Rights Act were challenged in the Supreme Court. Remind us what happened next in that case.
So later on in June, the justices issued a 5-4 ruling that struck down a portion of the Voting Rights Act. So it didn't strike down the whole thing, just a portion. But it was enough that for advocates of the Voting Rights Act, for some of these individuals who are in Selma, it was a very troubling development for them. They felt like the Voting Rights Act was being gutted. The protections that were put into place were being watered down. And it really, you know, has galvanized them and I think put voting issues back in the discussion in a way that they hadn't been, you know, for several decades.
Well, thank you, Andrew, for sharing that.
Thanks for having me.